We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From WILL Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn in for David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is our technical director. When individuals and groups of people are denied opportunity, they are not the only ones affected. The impact is much wider. Our guest this morning says this is an idea that is becoming accepted by more and more people, including economists and policymakers. The Geneva-based World Economic Forum, in its Gender Gap report, says there is a direct connection between a country's ability to tap the skills and talents of women and its economic success. Today, we'll talk about the growing economic impact of women. Our guest is Maddie Dykewald, co-author with Christine Larson of Influence, How Women's Soaring Economic Power Will Transform Our World for the Better. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Maddie Dykewald is a demographer, marketing executive, and entrepreneur. She and her husband, Ken, are the co-founders of AgeWave. AgeWave describes itself as a thought leader on our maturing population and the implications of that aging for business and society. Influence, How Women's Soaring Economic Power Will Transform Our World for the Better, is published by Voice, a division of Hyperion. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, will-talk@illinois.edu. Maddie Dykewald, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
My pleasure. When and how did economists and policymakers begin to realize that women's equality in the workplace is not a women's issue, but a serious factor in the global economy?
Well, believe it or not, it's actually pretty recent. The World Economic Forum started doing a gender parity report about 3 years ago to try to measure this because they wanted to take... They had this idea, really, that they could take this idea that it's socially correct to give women their equal place in the workforce and in the economy and get them well educated, but they thought that there might be some implications that were far greater than that, and they had no way to prove it except to go out and talk to people and get the stats, and in fact, that's exactly what they did, and the results of that were really pretty astounding. They found, frankly, that countries that educate their young girls and women actually had a bottom-line return. They had an increase in GDP, which is pretty remarkable, and suddenly developing nations started paying attention to this and started realizing that they needed to educate their young girls and young women, and countries like Morocco, who really never cared about that before, began to start taking this issue seriously.
Yeah. When I was in college in a course in economics, I had a very tough older professor who was had served in the Marines, and he, one of the things that stuck with me all these years was he said, if you hold someone back, you hold all of us back.
Well, that's exactly so, and actually there have been some studies. I mean, certainly there's anecdotal proof to that, but there have now been studies done that show that when you take an average group of both women and men and put them in one room to solve a problem, and you take a very far superior group of just men and put them in a room to solve the same exact problem, the diverse group of both men and women who are more average will come up with better solutions than that superiorly intellectual group of people, because the diversity of thought, of ideas, of the idea that you have different experiences growing up, these all help create better solutions.
You believe that as women gain more and more control over money, the world is starting to look different. How so?
Now, the world is starting to look very different. I mean, you can just look around in the media at how people are beginning to pay attention to this issue, that women are, in fact, the largest number. I mean, they represent the biggest group of college-educated people today. I mean, not just in the United States, in other countries as well. And it's beginning to translate directly into earning power. Women are beginning to take this earning power and begin to realize that they have a say in the way everything works. I mean, from the workplace to the marketplace to the family. I mean, no longer is a man a king of his castle. I think we can all agree to that. And even, frankly, to the way men operate in the world. It's beginning to change all those things in very distinct and interesting ways. Just as an example, in the marketplace, it used to be that very large buying decisions like automobiles and financial service products was the domain of men almost exclusively. And those companies that were in those industries would really market to men. And once in a while, they'd pay lip service to women. But that's just not the case anymore. Financial service companies all over our nation are beginning to realize that women could be their biggest opportunity, their biggest emerging market out there.
I think right now I want you to tell us a story, because I think the stories that you tell about women in this book, Influence, are very powerful.
Thank you.
The story that you tell that I would like you to tell our audience this morning is from the last chapter of the book involving Dr. Kathy DeAngelis. And let's go back to the year 1973. She's a young pediatrician, and she has a check for $50,000.
Yeah, it's a great story. For those of you who don't know who Kathy DeAngelis is, she's a pretty remarkable woman. She started as a nurse, got trained also as a physician, then went on to take on a lot of different roles in the medical industry, including, by the way, being one of the deans at Johns Hopkins University. And then she went on and today is the first woman editor-in-chief of the Journal of American Medicine. So that's a pretty huge deal. But back then, she was at Columbia University, and she was given this check, and she didn't know the right way to get that check turned into something of value for Columbia University, for a nonprofit, to make it happen. And she just went in, you know, like sort of a bull in a china shop, saying, hey, I got this check, what do I do with it? And the powers that be looked at her like she had done something wrong, rather than saying, wow, this is a really great and terrific thing that you have made happen. And instead, they put all these barriers in her way to trying to turn that into something of value for the pediatric division over at Columbia. And anyway, the long story short is they ultimately ended up helping her do it, but she didn't know, like many women don't know, the sort of how do you make things happen in an easy way, because we don't have role models for that. I mean, women are just gaining this power. We don't know how things are done, so to speak.
She was on the staff at Columbia, as you mentioned. She was raised in a working-class Milltown family. What would you like to tell us about her background?
Well, her parents, her father, actually saved money from his so-called lunch money to be able to send her to college. And at the time, it was really considered kind of outrageous for a woman to go to medical school. It was really the exception, not the rule, especially from someone from a working-class family. So she went to nursing school, and which is pretty, you know, at that point, she thought, this is fantastic. And once she was a nurse, she recognized the fact that she had this incredible interest in medicine and that she had to really pursue it on her own. And so she took out loans and did what many young women today do, but pursued medical school. But she was the only woman in her medical school class, and they put barriers in her way every step along her path to becoming a physician.
Yeah. Well, as you note in this book, Influence, Transforming a Culture Makes People Nervous.
It makes men nervous. Now, I wouldn't say all men. In fact, many men realize that this is fantastic. I mean, to create a partnership society where you get the best of women and the best of men, now that's pretty spectacular. But men who feel threatened by this, that it's either you or me, those are the ones who are very uncomfortable with this change. And by the way, you know, whenever you change the status quo, change is hard. people don't necessarily gravitate to say, yeah, give me change. I mean, that sounds terrific.
Well, what are the anxieties we're dealing with at the moment?
Well, look around at the world today and realize that there are, in many ways, some very big problems that we're trying to solve. There is a case to be made that men who hold most leadership positions, I mean, women have done a great job of getting to the middle place of sort of middle management, but not such a great job of getting into the highest levels of positions. I mean, we only hold 18% of all leadership positions even today, and that's no different than what we held back in the 1980s. So it's mostly men leaders who've gotten us to where we are in terms of the economy, in terms of our positions on global warming, all the major issues that we're facing today as problems. So we're beginning to realize that we need the best of all minds, men's and women's, to step up to the plate and help us solve these problems. And for instance, you're seeing a lot of the new powers that be in the world of financial services are women, because the financial services industry is beginning to realize, okay, we need a different point of view. We need to do things differently to regulate who we are and how we behave in the world. And women tend to behave slightly differently than men, not surprisingly.
Hmm. There are some indicators of where women are at the moment, and you note them very early in the book. Let me just mention them. More women than men are graduating from high school, college, and graduate programs in the U.S. Women hold more than half the parliamentary seats in Rwanda. In China, a country flush with newly minted millionaires, a young woman is the richest of the rich. This is a moment that historians will look back on, pointing their fingers and tracing the era on timelines for students of the future. See it there. See the rise of women at the dawn of the 21st century. That's from the book Influence. So the influence of women is growing around the world. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, let's first look just in the United States. I mean, 73% of all high school valedictorians last year were women. And, you know, even anecdotally, I have a son, Zach, who actually goes to Columbia University, and I mentioned this to him, and he said to me, well, of course, Mom. I mean, everybody knows that the girls really work harder and are kind of smarter than the guys. So there's this new attitude that young people have that girls, in fact, are more destined for success than young men. So that's a different attitude, and it's not just in this country. One of the people I interviewed, and I should put this into a context, I interviewed over 100 people for this book, women and men, some very influential leaders, some just normal, average people. And one of the women I interviewed was a young woman from Morocco, and she was telling me that in her village it was very much the exception for young women to be educated, and she was one of the lucky ones. She got educated and then was sent to a larger city in Morocco to attend college. And while she was attending college, she recognized the fact that she wanted to change life for young women back in her home village. So she began organizing fundraisers, everything from, you know, bake sales, believe it or not, over a four-year period, to fun runs, to a variety of different fundraisers. And she was able to raise in 4 years enough money to not only build a school back in her village that was for young girls, but also provide both the electricity and the water for that school. Now, that's a 22-year-old woman in Morocco, where women couldn't even get educated 5 years ago. So, I mean, it's a remarkable shift that we're beginning to see happen.
Hmm. Back to your son who's at Columbia, how does he see this? That was kind of an amazing statement he made to you.
Yeah, it is an amazing statement. And, you know, and he's a very ambitious young man himself. But he looks around him and remember, so he's at Columbia, and more than half the student body at Columbia are women, and plus they're affiliated with Barnard, which is a fantastic school that's exclusively women. So he's surrounded by bright young women, and frankly, he loves it.
This is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn in for David Inge. Our guest this morning is Maddie Dykewald. She's a demographer, a marketing executive, and entrepreneur. She's also an author, most recently with Christine Larson of Influence, How Women's Soaring Economic Power will transform our world for the better. Listeners, you can join us this morning with questions by phone or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Chapter 2 of Influence introduces readers to two women of influence, and perhaps what we should do now is back up before I launch into this particular story. But the hierarchy that we're talking about here in Influence, there are three stages, you say, of women's financial power. Would you name them and take us through them? Influence is at the top.
Sure. And let me put this into a context also. One of the things that I came up with when doing the research for the book is that there are actually some predictable plateaus that women hit as they begin to strive away from economic dependence, which is, by the way, where most women were a half a century ago, towards economic independence. And I looked around for a model, and in so doing, I came across psychologist Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And he talked about it in psychological terms. So what I discovered was that this model could, in fact, be applied to economic needs as well. So if you think about it in terms of a pyramid, at the bottom of the pyramid is the first stage, and there are three stages of what I call economic power for women. So the bottom of that pyramid, which, by the way, is the base, so it's the largest part of the pyramid, where more women are today than ever before. And that's good news in that they've moved out of economic dependency to get to at least survival. And that's when a woman starts making some money. She can take care of the basics, you know, put food on the table, clothing on her back and on her children's, get her children to attend schools. And, you know, they're actually very happy to get to that point. So that's survival. The second level of economic power would be what I call financial independence. And that, too, is a large part of that pyramid. And that's good news, and that's something different than ever before in our history, because we're seeing a critical mass of women, not just in the United States, but all over the globe, begin to reach financial independence. And that's when women have enough money to maybe move to a better neighborhood or send their kids to a better school. Maybe they can be a little choosier about the kind of jobs they'll take on. And what's different really is that women begin to experience financial independence in a way that they've never really seen before, and large numbers of women are doing that. And by the way, they may even be able to have enough left over to invest in their community or in a cause that they really care about. Now, at the top of the pyramid is what we call, or what I call, influence. And because it's the top of the pyramid, it's the smallest part of the pyramid. And we have the smallest number of women in that particular segment of the population, and that's got to change. By the way, the good news is that although we have more women in it than we did, say, 20 years ago, the women who are in this kind of economic power that I call influence are really very different than women were in the past. Now, women who used to be in this segment I call influence kind of felt like, well, it was sort of me or you. I mean, there's no chance for all women to succeed, so I'm really glad I'm going to succeed. Today, women who have influence realize that's not the case at all. Yeah. They realize that part of what they need to do is help more women get up to that stage of influence. And in fact, what they're trying to do is raise the boat for everyone. And that is a real change and something very positive.
Yeah. Well, now let's talk about Chapter 2, because this in stories tells us something about what you just said in a very nice way. Chapter 2 begins with you having lunch with a couple of women of influence. Tell us the story.
Yeah. Well, it's two remarkable women, I might add. Deborah Zeke is the founder of the Golden Door and of Rancho La Puerta, which are two, actually, she was an innovator, one of the first people ever to be in the world of health spas. And she completely created that space that has grown by leaps and bounds, as we know. She started it. It was still called a fat farm. So, I mean, she's really a remarkable woman who's moved on to also create a variety of different nonprofits. And she's in her 80s, and I happened to have been at Rancho La Puerta. I know Deborah for years and years, and I happened to have been at Rancho La Puerta with her, and she was having lunch with Marion Wright Edelman, and I got the opportunity to join them, and I was kind of blown away to be sitting down with these two luminaries. I mean, they're two amazing older women who were innovators in every sense of the word. And they were talking about basically school lunch and how the school lunch, which has become such a hot subject, how it needed to change pretty dramatically, that real food needed to be introduced. And Deborah had this idea to try testing a program that she had created herself in the California school system, which the California school system, as you may or may not know, living in Illinois, it's a mess. And school lunch program is a mess there. And she had this idea of bringing in natural, organic foods to people who probably have never before seen that kind of food. And she started describing the plan that she had in mind, which sort of seemed like pie in the sky if you were an outsider like myself. But as she was describing the program, Marion Wright Edelman started chiming in, well, wait a minute, I know exactly the company that can give you the money to start this up and test it. And within about 5 minutes, they had devised a plan for testing the school lunch program in the state of California and providing the funding for it just by sitting down and brainstorming together. I mean, they were trying to create something to help each other and also to make the world, as corny as it may sound, a better place. Mm. So I thought that was amazing.
Yeah, it's so interesting here, two women, one very interested in health and well-being, and the other interested in those issues for children. That's where they came from, and here they're coming together and doing, you know, launching a new initiative.
I know, it's amazing. And you know, in fact, they've gone on to do great things together. And by the way, Marion Wright Edelman was at Rancho La Puerta to work on her most recent book, and Deborah was providing a sort of a safe, quiet place for her to do it, which is another way that they're helping each other. So, you know, there's all this networking between them, these two pioneers who, oh, and by the way, one of the most interesting things that came out of that conversation that I don't think I said in the book was, you know, I said to them, boy, you're both, you know, you're kind of, you should be retired, right? Most people reach their 70s and 80s, and you think of them retiring. They said, no, we would never retire. There's so much more work that needs to be done in the world, and men have certainly made a mess of this. I feel, this is what Deborah was saying, that it's up to women to clean it up. And, you know, Marion Wright Edelman was shaking her head, yeah, yeah, we got to do this. Mm. So it was pretty interesting.
Where do you see this movement toward families and children and nutrition and good food and healthful living? Is it about to really take off, or are we past the takeoff point?
Well, that's a really good question, Celeste. I think it is about to take off. I think that it's sort of at a tipping point, and I think women are at the center of it. And I think that if you think about the power that women have, the influence, to use the word I use for my book, that women have, it's pretty amazing. They have this marketplace clout. I mean, women have always bought things. We all know that. But many people are starting to recognize the fact that they are the emerging market of the future. And just take the food industry. 93% of all food purchases are made by women. And women are very concerned about the health of their children and at all levels of society. And so, for instance, Safeway came out with their line of organic products that has done very well, and they actually sell it to other supermarkets because it's a low price point, and it also offers a high-quality product, which is exactly what women want to do. They want to figure out how to get the most bang for their buck, but the health of their families, no matter what level of economics they may be at, is the number one primary concern.
Yeah. I just want to put in a plug for a group in our community, the CU Fit Families. This is Champaign-Urbana Fit Families, and this is a coalition of folks from throughout the community that are working on these issues. And one of the conveners has been Illinois Public Media, WILL, and the Center for Family Resiliency at the University of Illinois. And it's quite the coalition, and it's really in its infancy, and it'll be great to see where it goes.
It sounds like a great program.
Yeah, CU Fit Families. In this chapter, chapter two, we also learn of a woman, speaking of families, who is moving toward, I would say, toward independence. Maybe she's at independence, but it's been a struggle for her. You call her Rosa Acosta. She's a mother of three. She's a housekeeper who earns $8 an hour. Tell us about her.
Well, she's actually, I actually have a funny story to tell about her. She's actually been a role model for a lot of people. What she did is she actually went to her client base to raise money. She went to all the customers who, you know, houses she cleans, and said to them, how can I get an advance from you, because I want to provide a better life for my family. I want to move to a better neighborhood, live in a better place. And so, in fact, they did advance her earnings for a six-month period so that she could, in fact, make that investment in herself and her family. And that turned out to be terrific. Now, as it turns out, I gave this book to my cleaning crew who comes in to clean my house, and they, in fact, did go ahead and read it. And they're from Brazil, and they're very wonderful women. They've worked for me for like 7 years. And they read this, and they came back to me and asked me if I would be willing with 10 of their other clients to advance their earnings for 6 months so that they could, in fact, expand their business. And I did. But it was a great thing, and it has already inspired other people to do something similar.
Wow, this is a pretty influential book.
Well, you know, it made me realize that in very small ways, we can all use our influence on a day-to-day basis to make the world a better place.
Yeah, well, tell us about that. There's a portion of the book that you devote to, you know, what can we do? Give us some ideas here now, please.
Okay, for sure. The key is that, again, no matter what economic level you're at, you really can use some influence every day. And I would really encourage your listeners, all of them, to think about how they might do that every single day of their lives. So one way is to start out by fostering your own financial knowledge and expertise. It is actually the number one best thing you can do. And remember, women live longer than men by about 5 to 7 years. And women are usually the ones who take time off from work to raise kids and care for their aging families, which can be a tremendous financial setback. So it's important for us to understand that we need to take care of ourselves for the long term. By the way, 90% of all women will be single at some point in their adult life. So, like it or not, we are responsible for our own financial future. So maybe it's taking a class at a community college, or even at, you know, a night school in a high school, or going online, you know, learning the basics of finance, and then beginning to make even small investments, even if it's just a few dollars a week. It's a really important step to take. So that's one thing I would say is the most important thing to do.
Yeah.
Another thing to do is to learn about, you know, what are the family-friendly work policies that some companies and some organizations support. First of all, it's fun to find it out. Second, it's easy. And third, you can then support policies that you really care about. That's easy to do also by logging on to familiesandwork.org or momsrising.org. To really learn what we should be doing, because our country does not support family-friendly work policies overall the way other countries do. And if we educate ourselves, we can then lobby personally for those rights. So that's another thing I would suggest. A third thing I would suggest is, for, again, something all of us could do, is to mentor our future leaders. You know, become a role model for that next generation of women. Maybe that's, you know, just for your kids and your kids' friends. Maybe volunteering for the Girl Scouts or Big Sisters of America. You know, a bonus of that is it usually makes you feel better also. So those are three easy ways. There's certainly other ways, too.
This is Focus. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you this morning with questions, your comments. They are invited. Join us with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. How do women use money differently than men?
Well, women actually have very different points of view about money than men do. I mean, keep in mind, for one thing, that men have a longer history of managing money. I mean, they usually were the ones who were the breadwinners in the past. Well, we know that's changed. Now, today, women are breadwinners just as much as men. I mean, they make up more than 50% of the workforce today, and a quarter of women out-earn their husbands. So we're beginning to see that women are a little bit more risk-averse than men. They're looking for security. One of the things that we did a huge study on women, money, and power that actually was what got me really interested in this subject. And part of the study, we discovered that women identified themselves in terms of money as worriers. Men identified themselves as warriors. So that's a pretty different perspective. I think during the recession, more and more men have become warriors, by the way, moving more into the line of fire with women as warriors. But they do identify themselves very differently. Women are very security-minded. In fact, more than half of the women that we spoke to said that they were very frightened of becoming broke and ending up on the street being a bag lady. And what made that particularly interesting was if they made more than $100,000 a year, they were even more likely to be worried that that would happen to them.
That's
we actually coined a phrase to describe this issue. We called it delusions of poverty, and women seem to have it in spades.
Yeah. What about men who have found their situation changed as a result of this recession, the daddy shift folks?
Yeah, it's become more and more common. I mean, we see it all around us, and it's very interesting phenomenon. Part of our study, what we determined was, again, a quarter of all women out-earn their husbands, and 7 out of 10 men were very comfortable with that reality. They felt like that was kind of good news. In fact, I'm sure that you've heard many times people refer to this recession as a man session because so many more men than women have lost their jobs.
Hmm. Our guest this morning here on Focus is Maddie Dykewald. She is a demographer, a marketing executive, an entrepreneur. She's an author. Her latest book, written with Christine Larson, is Influence: How Women's Soaring Economic Power Will Transform Our World for the Better. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, when you and your husband teamed up with others to do a study of gender, money, and power, what questions did you ask?
Well, we did two things. By the way, originally we were doing the study when we were first when we had a client who came to us and asked us to do this study. I was a financial services client, and we said, no, we don't really want to. It's really kind of out of our sweet spot, which was the aging of the population. But they came back to us, and they said, you know, we'd like you to do this study because you have much more objectivity. You don't have an agenda in this area. And so we did what was one of the larger studies. We talked to over 3,000 people nationwide, all over the United States. We did focus groups all in various cities, and we did a survey. And in the survey, we asked all kinds of questions. In fact, one of the things that we followed up in a separate study on was we asked women to self-select as to what kind of a financial personality they actually had in terms of money. And then we were able to segment women into one of five different personality types pertaining to money, which was kind of fun and also something that really resonated with women.
Yeah, I found myself in the partner category.
The power partner, yes. That was one of five of the personalities. And again, there were five personalities, three of whom were pretty empowered, two of which really needed some help.
Yeah, and I'm in the need some help department, I guess, then.
Well, no, I think you said power partner. Power partner is one. In fact, I would put myself in that particular segment also. Someone who, you know, my husband and I are partners in every sense of the word. Just to give an example, women who put themselves in the power partner segment are women who really put other people's needs before their own when it comes to money, and they really strongly advocate for their partner's needs as well as their own when it comes to money. They're usually pretty savvy around money, and they tend to err on the side of being very security-minded as well. So that would kind of describe, does that describe you?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I fall into that category too. There is a category that's very aggressive, what I call the alpha female. A smaller percentage of women fell into that category. But there are women who really behave exactly like an aggressive guy would behave, making, you know, shooting from the hip, maybe not even having all the information, but feeling very secure, making financial decisions, usually delegating that responsibility to a financial advisor because they have so much else going on in their lives that they can't really focus on it the way they'd like to. And then there's the group, also a very powerful group of women that makes up a third of all women out there. And that was the largest group, and that's what I call the perceptive planner. And the perceptive planner is someone who wants to do all their homework, mull things over for a long time, not make quick decisions, but make smart decisions on their own. And they've done very, very well. So that's another very empowered personality type.
Where are young women today?
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, you know, of course, I should add before I describe it is that people change in their lifetime. I mean, you can start out as one personality and move to another quite readily. In fact, I could wake up one morning and feel like I'm an alpha female and the next morning feel like I'm a power partner. I mean, it really is. There is a lot of fluidity between these, but young women tend to be what I called uncertain searchers, and that's not a good thing. Uncertain searchers are women who don't have a lot of financial knowledge and aren't sure exactly where to turn to get that financial knowledge. So they're very aggressive shoppers generally, but not aggressive savers or even sure how to even create a budget of any kind. So they really need help, and I would really urge young women who fall into that category, because there are a lot of young women who do, to get some basics, get some knowledge under their belt. And again, it's as easy as getting online and going to a site to learn the basics of financial management. And, you know, by the way, the jargon that financial services industry uses really gets in the way, especially for young women. And, of course, the other group of less empowered financial personality types is what I call the supportive traditionalists. And that's what most women were back in the 1950s, but today it's only about 10%, it's a little less than 10% of the population. And those are women who don't want to know anything about money. They choose to put it off on someone else. Maybe it's probably generally their husband, but could be a father figure, could be a boss, could be just a really good friend. But they just don't want to know about it, and they're not interested in learning about it. I mean, they might know where to turn to look for it, financial information, but they just don't want to know about it.
How long does it take to achieve confidence with money?
Well, what we determined in our study was confidence was one of those key ingredients that a woman needed to be empowered around money. In fact, it was probably, besides knowledge, the number one thing that was important. And I think gaining that knowledge begins the process of gaining financial confidence. Once you can feel that you understand the basics, you can start to feel like you can wield some power with your money. And then once you successfully kind of tiptoe into making financial decisions, every decision that you make makes you stronger and more confident to make better decisions moving into the future.
Mm. Well, let's talk now about a woman who's confident with money. You tell her story in this book, Influence, Ramona Capello.
Ramona Capello is an interesting woman. Yes, she's got confidence oozing out of her. She really does. I mean, she's been an amazing entrepreneur in her lifetime, but she started out in corporate America. Ramona is from California, and she runs her own company down in Southern California, and she started out, she attended USC, which, again, that was a big leap for her. I mean, she came from a family that, you know, she was one of the first educated in her family. And I think she was the valedictorian of her class at USC. If she wasn't the valedictorian, she was one of the top several students graduating. And she actually got into Harvard Business School, so, which would seem like a very attractive way to go. But, in fact, being uniquely herself, Ramona decided that she deferred her acceptance and was planning on going a few years later, which made a lot of sense too, I guess. But she got a job working at Nestle Corporation, and every step along her career, she kept doing things differently than anyone else. I mean, she began to realize that if she did things just the way the guys did, she would never really succeed. She had to find her own voice, which was her female voice, but, you know, uniquely Ramona's voice. And if she came from that, she found that she'd made very smart decisions and was really appreciated by her bosses. And even though she worked for a large company for a long time, she kept getting promoted up, 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 and up, and did very well for herself. But this is an important point to keep in mind. Ramona really wanted to have a family. And she found that along the way, she was so busy with work that it intimidated a lot of men. So she decided to take some time off, and during that time, she created her own company, and now she's actually doing very well. But she has found, which some women do find, is, you know, do women have to make a choice between intense career and having a family life? I mean, men don't have to make that choice. Should women have to make that choice? And we find that a lot of the very top women who are successful, somewhere along the line, they have to make that choice.
Hmm. So Ramona Capello is a woman who understands the value of a dollar, but she also knows it's not all about the dollar.
I'm sorry. I just lost what you said.
Okay. I'll say it again. She's a woman who understands the value of a dollar, but it's not all about the dollar.
No, it's not at all. And in fact, you know, she started the company that she now is, it's a startup. It's at its very early stages, and they're creating, like, healthy snack foods. And the reason she decided to create that company was because she was very, very close with her father, and her father had serious heart disease, and he was a total snacker. I mean, she was convinced that the snacking is really what caused him to have heart disease and to ultimately pass away. Mm-hmm. And so she really dedicated herself and created this company, you know, in honor of him, which is amazing.
For her startup, she needed capital. She got it, but finding capital can be tough for women. How tough, and what stands in the way?
Well, we call it the zeros problem. Women, it's so interesting when you think about how women do things differently than men. When men go out to sell a company, they have a tendency to really focus on the positives and to exaggerate them out slightly. They keep adding zeros to the bottom line, because remember that an investment banking firm or a venture firm, when they're looking to make an investment in a company, they're not looking to invest $100,000. They're looking for to invest millions of dollars, and if it's too small an investment, they're not interested. Women tend to underplay how much they need. Men tend to overplay, and therefore, the irony of this is women are being more pragmatic generally, but men are being more visionary, and investment firms, investment banking firms, and venture firms, they're looking for the visionary image. So if I were to give one piece of advice to a woman who's trying to raise capital, it's don't be afraid to ask for the money and to ask for the big money, even in today's marketplace.
Hmm. With all the things that we've talked about so far this morning, all the changes that are going on, is the culture of the workplace changing?
Yes. I think that this is, again, my whole concept is that women may be the biggest change agent of this decade. In fact, I believe that they will be. And we've already seen women in the workforce in a big way. And they've done two things. First of all, as entrepreneurs, women have done an amazing thing. They are starting their own businesses at twice the national average. So there, during the recession, when large companies were firing people, women-owned businesses were actually hiring people. So they've helped move us out of the recession, which is great news. The other thing that we've seen happen is that companies looking towards the future are beginning to realize that they may be firing people now, but what they're doing is laying off workers. What they're looking for always, even during a recession, is talent. And with women graduating from college in higher numbers than men and graduating from graduate schools in either equal or higher numbers than men, they are the talent. And that gives women enormous clout to wield in the workplace. And there was a recent study that was done by the Harvard Business Review and Bain & Company, which is a consulting firm, and they say that companies are going to have to go well beyond just flexibility to try to hold on to this talent, to retain that talent, which will be one of the big issues for companies moving into the future, especially after 2012, when the baby boom generation overall will begin to retire from some of their jobs.
Okay. Let's take a telephone call from a listener who's calling in from Oswego. Line 4. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste. Nice to hear you again. Yeah, your guess is right. The problem I see, though, is we have a dumbing down of our country. I mean, in a way, it's pay. I think we're going back to the 80s, mid-80s as far as income. And this goes for everybody. It's not just women. It's with men and in college and high school kids. I see people going backwards, about 50% cut in their pay from what used to be two, three years ago. Now, what it does is it makes the programs that employers look at a tighter program, who's willing to get, because eventually, with all these baby boomers retiring, you're going to look at people. Companies not putting into a 401k anymore. You're going to have to do it yourself. Pretty much, a lot of companies are already doing that. They don't want to have to pay for your insurance. They're gonna start pulling back in a lot of this. So it's going to be kind of tough for the next couple of years. But there was an article, I think it was in the USA Today or one of the papers, where they had three women on there who were in charge of straightening out Wall Street. And it's good. Everybody should get a leg up. I don't know why we can't get off the idea that women and men or whoever might be better than somebody else. It ought to go for whoever is qualified for that job. I mean, same thing with minorities. I don't know why we still get hung up on that. You go to apply for a job. You look at the resume. If this guy looks like he's able to do the job, no matter what it is, whether it be an entrepreneur or whatever, don't you think we should – that's the way things should be judged.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here now because we've got a number of issues there to sort through. Maddie Dykewald?
Okay, well, first of all, you're right. I mean, there was a Newsweek, I think it was a Time magazine cover that talked about the new sheriffs of Wall Street, Mary Shapiro, who's the SEC commission chair, Sheila Bair, who's the FDIC chair, and Elizabeth Warren, who's the TARP chair. And so it's ironic that, men, frankly, got us into this mess with the whole world of finances and the economy, and they're really relying on women to get us out. And that's an example, I think, as your listener was describing, of what I would call a meritocracy. I mean, getting a job based on your ability to your talents, frankly, you know, your ability to get the job done and get the job done best. So so that's good news. We are beginning to see more of this meritocracy. I think we're also beginning to realize that careers aren't linear anymore, and they're not straight up. Most people, men and women, don't work for one company their whole life, and most men and women don't have the luxury of having one of the two in a married couple stay home and take care of the kids. The idea of being on call for a company 24/7 it just doesn't happen anymore. So the whole career track is switching to be much more customized to meet the needs of an individual who is deemed to be talented. So I do think this merit, you know, hiring the best and the brightest is really the way to go.
Yeah, I want to thank the listener for his call this morning. Here to wrap up, you see a global power shift underway. What happens to those who don't get on board?
Well, they lose, really. I think that we're talking about not women. Or what I'm talking about, it's not women taking over for men, and we're not expecting those roles and responsibilities to shift completely. I think what we're talking about instead is women being equal partners with men, standing side by side with men, that the roles of breadwinner and breadmaker, they're not just decided on gender anymore. They're based on our talents and our abilities, and they're negotiated, frankly. And so I would say that in marriages, in families and communities, to the workplace and the marketplace, those companies, those individuals that recognize this and recognize that women will be the biggest change agent of the 21st century, really, and to get on board and see how that impacts them, those are going to be the companies and the individuals that succeed.
And again, I think here maybe we should emphasize that you see this shift as benefiting everyone, men, women, children.
I do. I see it being a win for everyone. Again, it's about creating a more partnership type of society.
Maddie, there we have to wrap it up. We're out of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Maddie Dykewald is co-author with Christine Larson of Influence, How Women's Soaring Economic Power Will Transform Our World for the Better. The book is published by Voice, which is a division of Hyperion.